I now continue with topic number 1. Under his $1 million a year contract with NBC, Kissinger was periodically taping interviews to be kept on hand for instant use whenever they might prove useful. All of Kissinger's answers that you saw and heard last Sunday were taped over 2 months ago on Saturday, January 20, 1979, but that session was not shown the next day on Meet the Press. Instead, the guest that day was Leonard Woodcock, newly designated ambassador to Red China. The footage you saw last Sunday of the panelists on Meet the Press was taped early that same morning, March 25. Each of the 4 panelists asked questions which were designed to fit Kissinger's answers of 2 months ago. In addition, several scenes were shot using a look-alike to be used at commercial breaks and at the end. In these brief scenes, the panel were seen on the left of your screen, facing the alleged Kissinger on the right. And as you may have noticed, the Kissinger stand-in sat as still as a zombie in those scenes without saying a word. Finally, computerized videotape editing techniques were used to splice together the new questions, Kissinger's old answers, and the break scenes. The net result was Meet the Press for March 25, 1979, a television hoax by NBC. The March 25 Meet the Press hoax preceded by only one day the signing of the so-called Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty here in Washington. The treaty is the end product of a process begun by Kissinger's own famous shuttle diplomacy. So the treaty should have been a prominent topic among the questions, and yet the fact is that not one single question was asked about the treaty. No one asked Kissinger the obvious question, "What do you think of the treaty?" Instead, the illusion of an up-to-date program was conveyed by means of clever wording of questions by the 2 NBC representatives, Bill Monroe and Richard Valeriani. In each case, a passing reference to the treaty was made in the course of asking about something else, such as the perennial West Bank problem. And during the entire program, Kissinger himself used the word treaty only in 2 brief sentences. These were edited into the beginning of the program for maximum psychological effect, but they said only what Kissinger began saying over 6 months ago, that we will be better off with a treaty than without one. The 2 NBC representatives dominated the program, asking 12 out of the total of 21 questions. And except for the deceptive references to a treaty, quote-unquote, the entire program was strangely out of date. For example, one question about the Middle East had to do with the prospects after Begin leaves office. With Begin here in Washington in triumph for the treaty signing, such a question was ridiculous. But 2 months ago, when Kissinger was taped, rumors were widespread that Begin might resign shortly. Likewise, one question about Nicaragua, of all things, was of current interest 2 months ago. But today? Even the questions about Iran were 2 months behind the times. There was not one word about the so-called Khomeini government of today. Instead, the questions and Kissinger's answers revolved around the fall of the Shah and who was to blame for it. When Kissinger was taped on January 20, those questions were right up to date because the Shah had just left Iran only 4 days earlier on January 16. But who is talking about the Shah today? My friends, what is most revealing about last Sunday's Meet the Press hoax is what was not asked. Kissinger played a key role in opening America's doors to Red China, yet there was not a word about the visit here by Deng Xiaoping last month. There was a flashback question about Kissinger's role years ago in regard to Vietnam, Cambodia, and Chile, yet China's just completed border war with Vietnam was not even mentioned. We have heard stories for weeks that Kissinger was vacationing in Mexico last month, yet Kissinger was asked nothing to shed light on the hostile reception Jimmy Carter received there last month. And strangest of all, there was not a word to acknowledge Kissinger's alleged terrible grief over the death of Nelson Rockefeller. In the dream world of last Sunday's Meet the Press hoax, it was as if none of these things had ever happened. And that is only natural, my friends, because when Kissinger was taped on January 20, they had not happened yet. Kissinger did not even have the impressive tan he was supposed to have gotten in Mexico. Instead, he appeared pale and unusually nervous. The nervousness, my friends, was due to the fact that on January 20, Kissinger knew that his own conspiratorial activities would lead to the murder of Nelson Rockefeller only 6 days later. My friends, the Meet the Press hoax was an act of desperation by the Bolsheviks. They want desperately for you to swallow it whole, to say, "Of course Kissinger is alive. I saw him on television." If you do that, you will be your own worst enemy in the Bolshevik game plan. They cannot keep up this charade for very long, but they are only playing for time, and not much time at that. Timetables have slipped before, but the Bolshevik target date to start shutting down our freedoms is the middle of May, only 6 weeks from now. And after the Bolshevik death grip is around our throats, they could not care less if we then realize that we have been tricked, because then it will be too late. Topic number 2. For hundreds of years, doubles, lookalikes, and imposters have been a recurring fact of life throughout modern civilization. Where the rich and the powerful and the ruling classes are involved, the pattern is always the same. Quoting once again from the book I cited earlier, The Pleasures of Deception, quote, "A monarch or heir to the throne dies, but in circumstances which leave the possibility of doubting that he really did die, at least to those who want to doubt it, and claimants come forward," unquote. When one considers the enormous empire which the late four Rockefeller brothers presided over, the attractions for imposters are overwhelming. And there's no need to resort to confidential information to recognize this much. For example, you might look over the book titled The Rockefellers by Peter Collier and David Horowitz, published in 1976 by Holt Reinhardt and Winston. It reveals such a major role in history and such family wealth that anyone who could get control of it all would put themselves in a very powerful position. The plunderers would gain not only the wealth and assets, but the power that goes with controlling the dynasty's fortune. If the heads of the dynasty were to vanish from the scene without this becoming widely known, the way would be open for doubles and imposters to enter the picture. The whole empire could be taken over, without eliminating anyone except the very closest associates of those who had secretly disappeared. Last month, I revealed that the Rockefeller family empire has now been placed in exactly this vulnerable condition. All four of the third-generation Rockefeller brothers have been killed in a Bolshevik coup d'état behind the scenes. And the deaths of the last two, David on February 9, and Lawrence on February 17, are being kept secret. Even the surviving members of the Rockefeller family who know about it, the widows and the members of the fourth generation, are keeping quiet about it. As I mentioned last month, they have been led to believe wrongly that silence is in their own best interest. And so the plundering of the Rockefeller family fortune is now underway in earnest. On one hand, the Bolshevik purge of those who were closest to the four brothers is continuing. The most conspicuous case of this lately was the murder of Dr. John Knowles, president of the Rockefeller Foundation, early this month on March the 6th. He was shot in the head. At the same time, doubles for David Rockefeller are now playing an important role in the Bolshevik plundering of the Rockefeller family fortune. Ironically, the most vulnerable part of the whole Rockefeller financial complex is its heart, the mammoth Chase Manhattan Bank. For many years, the late David Rockefeller was preoccupied with manipulating the worldwide tentacles of the Rockefeller cartel. One day he would be somewhere in the United States, presiding over a meeting to coordinate the actions of huge multinational corporations. Next, it might be a rush trip by private jet to the Middle East to patch up some problem there. For example, when David Rockefeller got word that his brother Nelson was dead on January 26, he was in Oman pressuring the Bank of Oman to stop buying gold. Had he not returned here for that emergency, his next stop might have been Singapore or Tokyo. On and on it went, always on the move. The world was David Rockefeller's oyster, and he all but ignored the pearl at the center, his own Chase Manhattan Bank. His constant travels made David Rockefeller a stranger in his own bank in recent years. He was so seldom there. And thereby, without realizing it, he developed a fatal weakness in his pattern of behavior. Like his brother Nelson, David Rockefeller had been subjected to psychological profile studies without his knowledge. And as with Nelson, David's weakness was discovered. He was not minding the store, that is, the Chase Manhattan Bank. As I mentioned last month, the closest associates of David Rockefeller would not be fooled for long in an intimate meeting with a double. But those close associates, my friends, are scattered worldwide. They are not found at Chase Manhattan Bank. And so the David Rockefeller doubles are using the bank itself as the open sesame to plunder the Rockefeller family riches. Obeying instructions, they are ordering the transfer of tremendous sums of money out of Chase Manhattan Bank and into Bolshevik coffers here and abroad. Meanwhile, they are keeping up the image of the late David Rockefeller by darting around on quick trips here and there. In this, they are being assisted by Bolshevik agents within the fabric of the Rockefeller network of banks, businesses, and publications. By means of the David Rockefeller doubles and other actions, the Bolsheviks are working like a swarm of termites, eating away the assets of Chase Manhattan Bank from within. Other banks, here and abroad too, are being affected by this process. Already, Columbia University in New York has begun dumping millions of dollars worth of bank stocks, including that of Chase Manhattan. And in the portent of things to come, a subsidiary of Chase Manhattan Bank has just filed for bankruptcy. When Chase Manhattan itself collapses, it will have staggering consequences for the banking system of the entire world. Last month, I revealed the beginning of the plundering of the Rockefeller family fortune. At that time, the Rockefeller fourth generation members did not know what was afoot. Now they do know, but are at a loss of what to do about it. The four and third generation brothers always kept tight control over the Rockefeller empire. As a result, the fourth generation Rockefellers were always left in the dark about what the brothers were up to and without any control over their own assets. But I believe now it's a time to remind the fourth generation members of the Rockefeller family and also the third-generation widows of the one time when they did exert their collective muscle and make it stick. I'm referring to the June 1974 conclave of 84 members of the Rockefeller family. The top item on the agenda for that conclave was to answer the question, "What shall we do about Dr. Beter?" The four brothers, John D. III, Nelson, Lawrence, and David, argued that I should be taken care of, quote unquote, before I could become well enough known to be dangerous to their plans. 2 months earlier, I had testified before Congress about the missing gold at Fort Knox. The brothers had easily prevented Congress from investigating my charges, but now I was going public with the story. The brothers did not admit that my charges were true in the conclave, only that they were dangerous. And they urged that I be silenced quickly by whatever means. But, my friends, the fourth generation said no. The brothers were told, in no uncertain terms, that the fourth generation would have no part in such a plan. As a result, the brothers decided instead simply to ignore me, to force me off the radio talk shows of which I had been appearing, and to let me say whatever I wanted, since I would be denied an audience. My friends, over the past several years, I've been asked countless times, "Why are you alive?" My basic answer is that I trust in the Lord Jesus Christ to protect me, and He has done so. But one of the concrete examples of that protection was the action taken nearly 5 years ago by the fourth generation Rockefellers. So if you have ever wondered why I have always made such a sharp distinction between the four Rockefeller brothers and the rest of the family, now you know. In all likelihood, they saved my life. Now, I would like to repay them, if only they will listen. If they will meet once again in conclave, they will discover that there are concrete steps by which they can retake control of what remains of the Rockefeller Empire for the good of all Americans. As I explained last month, the interests of the surviving members of the Rockefeller family are now identical with those of all patriotic Americans. And so, if they will seize this brief opportunity now, they can not only save what remains of their own assets, but more importantly, help save America. My friends, the Rockefeller survivors have a golden opportunity now to redeem themselves in the family name. By acting now, they can truly become the benefactors of society, which their forebears only pretended to be. But I must add this final observation as well. If the Rockefellers do not take courage and act as I have said, history shows clearly what their fate will be. Whenever the heads of a dynasty are overthrown or killed, those responsible always seek out and kill all survivors to make sure the dynasty can never rise again. That is what the Bolsheviks have in store for the entire Rockefeller family, if they do not now act to prevent it. Topic number 3. 3 days ago, on March 26, 1979, the Washington air was filled with the promises of peace, peace that always paved the way for war. Shortly before noon that day, Egypt's President Sadat and Israel's Prime Minister Begin joined Jimmy Carter on the lawn of the White House. In a dramatic open-air ceremony, the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty was signed. Then Sadat and Begin each spoke in glowing terms about achieving, after 30 years of hostility, peace between Egypt and Israel. Even Mrs. Sadat and Mrs. Begin had their turn, side by side at the microphones. Echoing the feelings of wives and mothers everywhere, Mrs. Sadat spoke of the blessings of no longer having to look forward to more war, suffering, and death. And in a display of pure joy, she abruptly leaned over and embraced Mrs. Begin. That same afternoon, with the ink barely dry on the so-called peace treaty, the Carter administration quietly signed two separate agreements with Israel. In one agreement, the United States has now given Israel an unconditional guarantee that it will receive all the oil it needs for the next 15 years. This agreement means that Israel will be completely unaffected by the coming destruction of Middle Eastern oil fields, and it is to remain in force no matter how severe the rationing will become here in America. The other agreement, or Memorandum of Understanding, pledges the United States to go to war against Egypt should the treaty break down. Egypt was not warned in advance about this second American-Israeli agreement and has reacted as if she had been betrayed, which she was. Meanwhile, Israel's Prime Minister Begin has been gloating over this agreement in public, calling it, quote, "a beautiful document, well written, and what it contains is very important," unquote. My friends, what we are seeing now is the culmination of the late Henry Kissinger's shuttle diplomacy of 3 and 4 years ago. In Audio Letter 6 for November 1975, I explained what the Sinai Accord was all about. It consisted of a pair of treaties, one between the United States and Israel, the other between the United States and Egypt, and the purpose of the Sinai Accord was to lay the groundwork for a Middle East war that would involve the United States. As I said then, the Middle East war plan was to involve a limited nuclear strike against Arab OPEC oil wells, jointly by the United States and Israel. Since I first revealed this basic plan over 3 years ago, events have caused it to be delayed and revised several times, but now it is moving along fast as part of the Bolsheviks' game plan. They want to use the coming Middle East crisis to shut down America in a Bolshevik revolution before going to war against Russia. And right now, cadres of Bolsheviks are pouring into the United States, most all of them experienced in revolution tactics and strategy. Shortly before the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917, the ruling circles of the United States sent more than 1,500 of these people to Russia to foment revolution. Now they are returning to do the same thing here in the United States. Beginning with the strange death of John D. Rockefeller III 8 months ago, control of America began shifting rapidly to these satanic Bolsheviks. And last August 1978, in Audio Letter 37, I was able to reveal their master strategy to build up to a nuclear first strike against Russia. It's a prescription for up to 350 million people to die worldwide, all to no avail. But it's do or die for the Bolsheviks. They would rather have all of us die than to give up their own dreams of total world domination. And the key to this catastrophic plan lies in igniting the long-delayed Middle East war. We have already been given a sample of what lies ahead for us in the Jonestown, Guyana tragedy. 4 months ago, I devoted Audio Letter 40 in its entirety to the military operation that took place there and the role played in that operation by the mass murder. As I revealed then, Israeli commandos were the key to the success of the operation. It wiped out the secret Russian missile base I began warning about over 4 years ago. My friends, the joint American-Israeli operation in Guyana was only a dress rehearsal for the coming joint American-Israeli limited nuclear strike against Saudi Arabian oil fields. In Audio Letter 37, I explained how the plan was to begin with a supposedly surprise success in the Camp David talks last September. The goal was to be an eventual treaty between Egypt and Israel, set up in such a way as to drag in the United States. And now this situation is a fact, and the Hate Saudi Arabia campaign is also far advanced, right on track as I reviewed it in Audio Letter 41. Soon, a major manufactured incident in the Middle East will scuttle the peace treaty. The ensuing nuclear destruction of Saudi Arabia's oil fields will give the rulers of both Israel and the United States what they want. Freed of any concern about her own oil supplies, Israel will be free to destroy the engine of Arab economic power, oil revenues. And the resultant cutoff of oil supplies will give our Bolshevik rulers here in America the excuse to shut down our freedoms under the guise of a national emergency. Quickly then, they plan to bring us all under total regimentation as America gradually shifts onto a full war footing. My friends, the time left to us is very short, and yet there is one last chance left if we will take it. The rulers of Russia today are Christians. Right now, the actor Pope who masquerades as the dead Pope John Paul II is preparing to create trouble in Poland. By contrast, Russia has just invited over 200 Polish priests into Russia to begin opening monasteries, schools, and churches there. 2 years ago, I began asking, where are the churches in this hour of need? I urge now that American church leaders at all levels and from all denominations band together for a pilgrimage for peace to Moscow. Pastors and other church leaders who want life and freedom for America instead of death and destruction can do this for our Lord Jesus Christ. Therefore, I urge you to call my business number here in Washington, D.C., area code 202-659-3999. Give me your name, address, telephone number, and what your church position is so that you can be contacted later. My friends, it's up to you to make sure Christian leaders and church leaders all over America hear this message in time to respond by April 30, 1979. When I record AUDIO LETTER 45 next month, God willing, I plan to tell you whether or not American church leaders have responded in great enough numbers to rise to this occasion. If that takes place, and a massive pilgrimage of church leaders can be formed to visit the Kremlin leaders, perhaps they can be convinced that the Bolsheviks have not infiltrated all of our churches. And if that is true, perhaps we can turn aside the Bolshevik war plan. But if church leaders here do not respond, Russia's leaders will continue to believe as they do now. They are convinced that what happened to the Russian Orthodox Church 60 years ago has now happened to the churches here in America. And if that is true, then God help us all. Until next month, God willing, this is Dr. Beter. Thank you, and may God bless each and every one of you.